Okay, well, welcome everybody to this session about the economic crisis and the ecological crisis and the connections between those and the connections between the kinds of things that might address those, that might go beyond this economic crisis and the simultaneous world eco-crisis. We organised this session because we, I think, rightly suspected that the election campaign and the debate, such as it is, around the election, was unlikely to get to the heart of the problems, the economic and ecological problems that humanity faces currently. And I think that expectation has been borne out by the, what I think is sort of utterly superficial, almost ridiculous kind of debate that's going on at the moment between the three major parties. Of course, excluding more, overwhelmingly, the media are excluding more radical voices and more radical ideas. So this what we hope to do in this session was to try to air some radical ideas, some ideas from the left, essentially, about these problems. And what we're going to do is, sorry, I should have introduced myself. I'm Jamie Gough. What we're going to do is that I will speak first about the causes of the crisis, because it's quite extraordinary how the media and the politicians seem to have just completely forgotten how we got into, and saying really very little or nothing about how we got into this dire economic situation. So I will speak first for about 20 minutes talking about what I see as the roots of the crisis. Then we'll have about 20 minutes or so for discussion. And then John Smith, who's also from Sheffield University, hi, will speak about some strategies, some political strategy to address this economic and also ecological crisis. Then we'll have a bit of a break, about half an hour break for coffee, and we can enough time to talk to each other and chat a bit. And then Ian Rotherham, who's from Hallam University, will then talk about, eco and I suppose also economic, but especially green policies to address these twin crises after the break. So that's where we're going to go. Okay. I've got a little couple of little overheads here. But they're mainly just to remind me what I'm supposed to be going to talk about. So I'll try to cram this into about 20 minutes. Now, as I'm sure you you all know, the immediate form that this economic crisis has taken has been the credit crunch, so-called credit crunch, or the crisis of the world financial system that emerged in 2008, and which originated in essentially in the appearance of vast quantities of bad debt. Initially in the American mortgage market, but then in all sorts of other things as well. And since this debt had been sold on, repackaged in all sorts of ways, and in that way kind of spread through the financial system. The emergence of that unpayable debt then ricocheted through the financial system and resulted in an inability, well, a bankruptcy of a whole number of financial institutions and an inability of the whole world financial system to lend. This then naturally then led to a recession, that is to say, in a sense, a drop of demand, a drop of output, and consequently a drop of employment, unevenly between different countries, but essentially taking place globally. And then the next stage was the action of various governments, including that of Britain and the United States, in attempting to bail out the banking system by basically shoving an enormous amount of public money into the banking system, to some extent rescuing that system, but at the expense of public finances. So, as you know, we now have this situation in Britain of a massive public debt which has been incurred in order to bail out the banking system and also as a result of the recession itself. So, the dominant discourse about these events has been that the problem, the essential problem, the root of this problem, originates in the financial system itself. In particular, it said, the finance system got out of control in the sense that the financiers were lending in a highly risky way. They were lending wildly without having sufficient collateral, if you like, or sufficient assets to set against, safe assets to set against their lending, that they were wild and irresponsible, as I think Gordon Brown put it at one stage, irresponsible. And that therefore the cure for this is to make the finance system more regulated, for states to restrict what the financiers can do with their money in their lending, and particularly to prevent them from lending as much as they were during the noughties, if you like, the 2000s. And what that account does is to really take the immediate form that the crisis took, which was a financial crisis, and say, okay, well, the cause must therefore lie within the finance system itself. It's the fault of the bankers. Now, I think that's very superficial. I don't think that gets to the root of the problem, unfortunately. I think the problem is deeper than that. I think it's actually the problem is lies in the capitalist system as a whole, the world capitalist system as a whole, not just in its financial part. And therefore, the remedies need to be much more radical than just going off and regulating the banking system. And I'll try to very quickly outline why I think that's the case. To do that, I need to go back a little bit historically. In the late 1960s early 1970s, the world economy, in particular that in the advanced countries, the rich countries, went into a big economic crisis. Which was essentially a crisis of profitability. The average rate of profit in the world economy had been falling gradually through the great boom of the 1950s and 60s, And by the early 1970s, it had actually fallen to a very low level. And consequently, that boom came to an end, and the world economy entered a period of prolonged economic crisis. This, rather importantly, stimulated an enormous amount of class struggle, what I would call class struggle, or in taking the form of industrial struggle, but also a whole lot of urban struggles around the welfare state, around housing, the emergence of the women's movement, the black movements in various countries, and so on. So there was a lot of social conflict and economic conflict around that time as well, bound up with and partly a result of this economic crisis. So what happened then was that big business, especially in the richest countries, and in particular in the United States and Britain, adopted a strategy to try to deal with this economic crisis and also the political crisis, all these social conflicts that were going on. And that strategy was neoliberalism. Okay, what we now call neoliberalism, or used to call in Britain Thatcherism. And business saw this strategy of neoliberalism as a solution to this economic and political crisis that had emerged. What did this consist of doing? It said, neoliberalism said, instead of having collective organizations and the state, quotes, interfering in the economy, what we'll do is we'll leave the economy up to markets, that is to say, up to individual economic actors, individual firms, individual workers, individual consumers, relating to each other through markets. And in that way, that will reduce this level of politics, of political conflict, politicization that was taking place, because instead of people looking to collective organizations or politics to try to solve their problems, they will simply have to look to themselves and the property they own. Okay, so it's a depoliticizing process imposing the market rules. Neoliberalism, as I'm sure you know, also involved austerity for workers, holding down or reducing wages, rising unemployment, greatly increased discipline intensification of work within the workplace. It also meant greater mobility for capital. So the central part of the idea of neoliberalism was to allow capital of whatever sort, industrial capital, financial capital, commercial capital, and so on, to become much more mobile, to move out of sectors and places that weren't so profitable and to move into ones that were more profitable somewhere else. So that kind of mobility was very important, seen as very important to resolve this problem of profitability. And also this mobility, of course, also acted as further discipline on workers, because workers could be threatened with losing their jobs if they held out against the demands of their employers. And an implication of this greater mobility for capital was the deregulation of finance. Finance was to be allowed to do much more what it wanted to do, to go much more where it wanted to, and so on. So the deregulation of finance was an integral part of this whole program. The current discourse says that the deregulation of finance was some sort of mistake, which we can kind of go back on partly in some way. What that underestimates is that the deregulation of world finance was an integral part of this neoliberal program. whoops. What that led to in turn, so that came in sort of in the 1970s and through the 1980s, that neoliberalism was unrolled. In terms of finance in particular, and the supply of money and the supply of credit, which is really the main form of money in the modern economy, there was a slightly strange history, actually. In the early 1980s, money and credit were restricted by governments, which was what people referred to at the time as monetarism. They restricted the supply of credit and money, and therefore, through that means, imposed a kind of money discipline onto firms and onto workers. Basically, it was said, you can't borrow your way out of this austerity. You have to increase productivity, you have to lower your wages, you have to increase your competitiveness if you're a firm, and so on. You can't borrow in order to get your way out of that. So it was a kind of using the market to kind of squeeze the economic actors initially. That was the first stage of neoliberalism. But from the late 80s, and especially in the United States, led by the United States, that was almost turned completely on its head. And the from the late 1980s, you began to get a big expansion of credit created by the financial system itself. So the financial system was allowed to start lending and, in a sense, creating money on a massive scale. And I think the reason for that, and that was led by the American government, the Federal Reserve, under its leader, Mr. Greenspan. And so there was a policy of expanding credit and having low interest rates, lowering interest rates to make it easier to borrow. Now, I think the reason for that was that the initial stage of neoliberalism didn't solve the problem of profitability. The world economy was still in a very bad way from the point of view of capital. Profits weren't large enough. There wasn't strong investment going on the whole. And so both firms, all three actually, firms and governments and consumers wanted to borrow in order to increase their increase their incomes, or in the case of firms, their investments, and so in a sense, you could say this credit, this huge expansion of credit that then took place, was an attempt to float the economy back up to some sort of growth path, if you like, the global economy onto some sort of growth path. Again, this expansion of the credit system and the finance system, again, wasn't a mistake. It was a reaction to the fact that the economy, the global economy, was remaining very stagnant, and that the austerity imposed on workers in particular was not enough to float the economy into another long period of expansion. What did that result in then? What that resulted in then was waves of investment. There was, in a sense, a lot of cheap credit, a lot of cheap money around, which investors of various sorts could use for investment. And that did indeed stimulate investment in certain ways. However, the investment that it stimulated was very unstable. Very unstable. And has taken place in, so to speak, waves, where you get essentially what are essentially fads. Investors decide that such and such a type of production or such and such a type of asset, economic asset, is the thing to throw their money into. And like lemmings, they And out of a kind of desperation to find some profitable investments, they all pile in to those areas of investment. But the result has been over and over again over this 30 odd year period that you then get excessive investment in some relatively narrow field, and resulting then in a bust. So you have the booms and the busts, and that's been true of in particular of production. There have been some areas of production, that is to say, facilities to produce goods or services, let's put it that way, sort of the real economy, if you like. There have been some areas of production in the world that have had very big waves of investment over this period. Perhaps the notable case would be investment in manufacturing in East Asia in the 80s, the 90s, and indeed to some extent in the noughties as well. But this productive investment hasn't been going on in a kind of even way across the world economy. It's been very much channeled into very particular places and sectors, and that's clearly the case with this investment in manufacturing in East Asia. Another area of production real economy production during this period has been a favourite one. Has been property. Commercial property, to some extent also housing. Construction, the construction industry, in some countries and regions and places and cities, at certain times, there have been massive waves of capital going into building. Of commercial premises and so on, and of housing, but the dot-com boom was another one. If you count the dot-com internet companies as a kind of production, as a kind of part of the real economy, it wasn't a sort of, I suppose. The dot-com boom was another famous boom in the late 1990s, where tons of capital piled in. But in that case, within about 3 years or so, the market was saturated. There was so much capacity had been built up in this rather narrow field that it then collapsed. So there's been these waves of investment in production. There's been also waves of investment in assets. Economic assets like, already built property, for example, can speculate in property values. Indeed, in a sense, housing is an asset which both firms and people have attempted to speculate in, but also stock markets, also all sorts of fancy financial derivatives, and so on. These also have received huge waves of investment at certain times, and in an attempt by this, that, so you had this large amount of credit available, large amount of money, if you like, looking to be invested, and. Because the possibilities in production have been rather narrow, a lot of the money has instead gone into pure, if you like, what you could call pure speculation in assets, buying an asset because you think it's going to go up. And of course, with all asset bubbles end in tears, inevitably, because the thing goes up and up and up and up and up. And then suddenly people realize, you know, how on earth is this asset worth this stratospheric amount of money? And people get frightened and start selling the stuff. And then the moment they start selling, everybody has to sell, so they all start selling. So it all goes down again. So you get these crazy, absolutely crazy roller coasters of speculation in assets. So these waves of investment in both in production and in assets, it's those waves which created a series of crises throughout this period. The crisis we're in now is by no means the first. You've got world crises, really. Well, they were world crises in those times. You also got, for example, a huge financial crisis in the United States already in the 1980s with the deregulation of the Savings and Loan Associations, for example. Trillions of dollars, I mean, vast amounts of money, were lost in essentially financial speculation. So this has been going on, and the credit crunch of 2 years ago is just the latest of these crises. And I think what we're seeing here then is that this credit and all this finance was expanded and built up in order to try to stimulate, if you like, to try to stimulate the productive economy. In the sense of real economic growth, of the kind that you had in the 1950s and 60s. But it's failed. It's patently failed to do that. What you've had is economic growth in rather narrow sectors, in very particular places, and speculation in assets. And I think that's a sign that the underlying problem of the world economy, of lack of fundamental profitability for capital, lack of fundamental profitability for business, particularly in the real economy, I mean, in production, remains. It hasn't been solved, and that's why these booms. Like the general boom you had in the 90s, the general boom that you had in the noughties, that's why they come crashing down. They come to an end. They're not sustainable. So my conclusions very quickly. Right, I've gone on too long. What conclusions would I draw from this? Well, that this crisis originates not in lack of regulation of the financial system, but in something much more fundamental, a much more fundamental malaise, if you like, of the global economy, including production, including, if you like, the real economy. The things which have been tried over the last 30 years and failed seem to me to indicate that actually the capitalist system, at least in its modern contemporary form, really doesn't have a solution. They don't have a solution to this economic malaise and the terrible crises that it produces. In particular, this terrible world crisis of the present. There isn't a solution, and so in a very very sort of schematic way, I would say we need to start thinking about socialism, about a socialist way of organising the economy, which I take to mean a need for the planning of productive investment to meet human needs, not to rely on firms to pile into very particular narrow realms of production as it suits them, and then to back away from them and withdraw from them and so on. But the planning by us all, the world population, ultimately, of the investment, of the productive investment that we need in a way that meets human needs and also meets the needs of the ecosystem. That for me means that the ownership of capital needs to be transferred to the people, to us. If you like, us collectively. And away from its control by private interests, because its control by private interests simply leads to these endless boom and bust crises. Okay, so I'll stop there.
I haven't actually been asked to be chair of this session, but I think I ought to.
Yes.
So what we'll do first of all is just ask for any questions that people want to ask to clarify any matters, and then throw the discussion open. Something about particular question at the front first.
A slightly eccentric question. I'm a coin collector, and I have these coins with SETC. This is the South Sea Trading Company, which isn't remembered as such, but what people remember is the South Sea bubble.
Ah, yes.
I've been slightly curious, really. I wonder whether the credit crunch should have been actually called the banking bubble, whether that actually would have been a better description of what had happened.
I agree. As long as you've had capitalism, you've had these speculative bubbles, and that was in the mid 18th century. So we're talking 200 years ago. Where are we? No, more than that. That was a good example of an early example of this kind of speculative fever that sets in, that certain people start buying an asset, which in that case was, I think, the rights to trade with the South Seas or with Asia, in certain sort of speculative trading ventures. But once people start buying these bonds or whatever, then everybody thinks, oh, I can get rich quick too, and that was certainly part of this financial bubble in the noughties, in particular the buying of property assets. But also the buying of these derivatives and so on, more and more fancy financial products, which were being thought up by people like Mr. What's his name at Goldman Sachs. What's this guy who's just come a bit of a cropper, perhaps? let's hope. But the investment banks and so on invented more and more fancy products, which they could sell to the major financial institutions, particularly like the pension funds and the insurance companies and the big main banks and so on. And packaged them up and sold them, and these financial institutions, were dead keen on these, as well as hedge fund speculators who were more pure speculators, were dead keen on these derivatives because they were going up. So everybody wanted to buy, get in more. Yeah.
There's a question right at the back first.
Jamie, can you just explain a bit further derivatives and the subprime market?
Right. The subprime market is always used about housing, and it's what it describes is the giving of mortgages for house buying, for freehold housing, and. What it refers to directly is, particularly in the United States, there was a lot of lending in the 2000s, particularly, to relatively poor families and individuals to buy houses. Now, the and sort of parts of the American population who hadn't previously been able to get a mortgage could suddenly get a mortgage. And the finance system was shoving money at them, in a sense. Particularly of black people, for African Americans and Hispanic Americans, but poor people in general. And the now the reason that the finance system wanted to do that was that, as I was talking about just now, the capital was desperate for places to invest, and also because interest rates were pretty low, kept low, and there was a lot of this sort of money capital sloshing around. The finance system as a whole decided that it would be a good idea to find new borrowers. They were desperately looking around for people to borrow, who were willing to borrow. On the other hand, the American working class has endured 30 years of falling real wages. The austerity in the United States is quite extraordinary over this period under neoliberalism. I think it's true that the average wage in the United States, in real terms, is about the same. The average wage is about the same as it was 30 years ago. But the upper incomes have gone up, and the higher the income, the more it's gone up. But the corollary is that the lower incomes have gone down. So they've actually reduced in real terms. So many, many American workers are now earning maybe 30% less in real terms than they were 30 years ago. So their incomes have been absolutely appalling. So, and therefore, they've been unable to afford housing. There's then this offer of cheap mortgages come along. So of course, a lot of those poor Americans take up that possibility. The problem comes, and so you might say, "Oh, well, that was good. The capitalism has worked out a way of housing the poor in America." The problem came when interest rates went up. And so many, many people then, in this so-called subprime market, because they were then unable to pay, and the debts became bad debts. The finance system then realized that they had a huge amount of paper assets that were only there on paper and didn't actually have any value. But which have been packaged up into all sorts of fancy so-called derivatives, and so on. So you've got this ricochet coming through. But you can see the way in which this subprime problem is sometimes presented, again, as a kind of mistake. You know, as a kind of mistake of regulation. The American government should have regulated this mortgage market better. Required greater collateral from the borrowers, prevented the banks from lending to people who were very poor or whatever. But in fact, I think it you can see that a certain way in which it fits within a much bigger picture of both the people desperate to borrow and of finance desperate to lend, because of essentially the world economic crisis. So then the other thing you asked was derivatives. A derivative means it's an asset whose value depends on other assets. So its value derives from other assets. Okay. So you take a set of assets, which of course are all just bits of paper, really, You package these bits of paper together. You say, all these bits of paper together are worth such and such. What are you willing to give me for it? You know, and then you have this other asset, which is a single piece of paper instead of lots of bits of paper, which you can then buy and sell on, and then that maybe gets packaged up with some other bits of paper. Some of these bits of paper take the form of futures, so they are really bets on asset values in the future. So it's even more speculative. It's not even the asset value now, it's what the asset value will be in 1 year's time or 5 years' time or something. And that's a derivative.
Okay, there's quite a few hands going up here. What I'd suggest would be that I'd take a bunch of questions.
Okay, and then
package them up.
We could also probably have some
comments as well. I've seen three people here anyway, sorry.
Isn't the problem with changing to your sort of system that you've got sectors, the rich sector of society that wants to get richer, and the only way they can get richer is if the poor get poorer, so that they grab the money in other words? And in fact, I think this is perhaps even human nature, that we never feel we've got enough and we always want to be better off than the next person, our neighbour. They've actually done research and found it doesn't matter how well off you are, you never feel you've got enough money. So, you know, as I see it, and I've lived through all these crises, that you're going to be fighting against the wealthy to change the way it is because they benefit from it.
You had your hand up there, Zach.
It's really your answer to Joel's questions about this. You premised your introduction by the decline in the falling rate of profit, or the falling rate of profit over the last 30 years since, say, the 70s.
Yeah.
And yet, when you talk to explain the subprime market, you also talked about particularly the attack on American workers and their decline of income. The two don't seem to fit together. In other words, if there is a declining rate of profit, so companies are earning their shareholders less, and there's less going to wages.
Right.
Where's
I see. Where's the money?
I was wondering if you wanted to say anything about the kind of the effect of oil and the oil prices on these crises, because the kind of August 2008, just before the kind of crash, was kind of global. That was the month in which global production, monthly production, peaked to its highest level ever. The highest ever annual production was in 2005. It appears that we've probably past peak oil. However, it's really not clear how much oil is in Iraq and how quickly it can be extracted. So it's quite possible that global peak oil might happen at some point in the next few years.
Okay.
But, you know, it's around about now. I mean, in terms of the last kind of crash, it appears to me that one thing that probably played a role in that was people speculating on peak oil being true and people expecting the price of oil just to go up and up and up. This drove the price of oil up and up and up.
Yes,
and I think this is one of the key things that caused the crash. And then the reduction in prices, which is now creeping up again, obviously, of oil, was caused as a massive destruction in a massive loss of demand due to the economic crisis, so therefore the prices kind of slip back down again. But now, as demand, you know, begins to creep up again, the capacity isn't going to be there. It appears to me that we're going to see a series of oil price spikes and crashes over the next few years as things kind of go on. And I was just wondering if you wanted to say anything about that, about oil.
Okay, well, those three questions to be gone on.
Yeah. All right, okay.
Perhaps have another round. And you say this coffee is going to be ready at 11 o'clock? All right, so perhaps after this round.
We could
squeeze another round in if you're able to.
Yes. Yes, right. Yeah, it would be nice if also people were able to contribute as well as ask questions. Just on the greed thing. I'm skeptical about this argument that human beings are inherently acquisitive and greedy. I think we are made like that by capitalism, within capitalism. If you look at most tribal societies actually, those people are not out to get richer and richer and consume more and more. In fact, most tribal societies, it appears, historically at least, people worked for perhaps 2 or 3 hours a day to produce for their needs and then spent the rest of the time in leisure and pleasure. But I think that capitalism, through all sorts of ways, through artificial creation of needs, and also through the link between consumption and status, which is socially created, I think, has made people greedy, if you like. There's also a sense in which capital itself, pure capital, is in a certain sense is greedy, although that's probably not quite the right word. Capital itself really has no other rationale but to expand. If you're a corporation which has assets of let's say £100 billion, there is nothing else to do but to expand that so it's £110 billion. That's all that you can do. That's the only kind of trajectory, right? That's the only rationale of capital in itself. So that tendency to expand endlessly, I think, is there both as a social phenomenon for ordinary people like us or whatever, and especially for the richer people, but it's also there in a sense in capital itself. This terrible tendency to expand. Marx actually talks about this in his book Capital. He argues that the thing that characterizes capital is not the consumption of the rich. Capital doesn't expand in order that the rich can, you know, have more yachts and things. It expands because it has nothing else to do, in a sense. It is just pure value, pure money, which just needs to expand endlessly. And for me, one of the great reasons for socialism is to get away from both those kinds of endless expansion, aside from anything else, because of the ecological crisis. I think, capitalism is incapable of I mean, it's inherently anti-ecological because of this expansionist tendency, both of consumers, but even more particularly of capital itself, which seeks to expand production endlessly, and without limit. The kind of, well, the sort of thing I was saying at the end of my talk of a society the democratic planning of production, is really sort of intended to get away from that. On this question of the rate of profit and wages, my argument was really that the rate of profit reached on average across the global economy reached a particularly low point in the 1970s. In the case of Britain, I think something like 1975, it was down to 2% return on capital. A so-called normal return on capital is about 20% a year. Expect to get about 20% a year back on your profit. It was in Britain at that time, it was down to 2%. I mean, absolutely, virtually nothing. They were virtually not making profits. And of course, that meant a lot of losses. A lot of firms were making losses. Now, the neoliberalism was designed to try to increase that rate of profit. One of the ways was to reduce wages wherever possible, and that's been particularly dramatically done to the American working class to reduce the wages. Now, that certainly contributed to increasing the average rate of profit. The fact that American workers have been paid less and less has increased the profits and the rate of profit of American capital in particular. So the average rate of profit across the world economy has indeed improved from the point of view of business in the last 30 years or so. However, and it's been as you implied, partly through reducing wages. However, this rate of profit has been quite cyclical. Because of these booms and busts, you get a sort of healthy-looking rate of profit at the height of the boom, but then you get these busts, and the rate of profit then goes down to God knows what, but certainly declines very sharply. But even at the height of these of the booms that we've had, say the boom of the noughties and the boom of the 90s, the rate of profit was still, although it was higher than the 70s, it wasn't as high as the 1960s. In the 1960s, which was really the end of the boom period, the last part of the boom period, the rate of profit was quite a bit higher than anything that's been achieved by neoliberalism, basically. Finally, the spikes in the oil. Yes, there's something I forgot to mention. And you're quite right that one of the major types of asset that's been a field of speculation for capital in the last 30 years or so has been raw materials in general, and oil in particular. Oil, obviously, the biggest one of those. And that has incidentally had a terrible effect on the producers of many of those minerals and so on, because it's made the price of those things so incredibly unstable. The price is not determined by the supply and demand of the moment only, but also by these speculative activities. As in when I think it was in the 1990s, there was those two brothers in the United States who basically bought up the entire world's supply of silver, and they just bought it up as a speculative thing and forced the price up and everything. But probably more important than that is the peak oil question. That if we really are reaching the peak oil situation, because capital seems to be completely unable to reorganize the economy away from oil use, away from its utter dependence on oil and gas. It's just not, patently not capable of doing it. And so when the oil and gas start to run out, that will inevitably have a devastating impact on, especially on the weaker parts of the world economy, which means the third world in particular. I mean, the third world is just going to be devastated by the rises in prices and the lack of energy supply.
Okay, we're very close to 11 o'clock. It's time for perhaps one more question or comment. Yes.
Yeah, it's from a slightly different angle, but how far would you agree that one of the consequences of the economic crisis, is the deterioration in people's health, the general health factors? The pressure of people to keep up, the pressure to do well, to have a good job, to have a house and a car. A tremendous increase in mental health problems.
Yeah, absolutely.
And those are the factors then that more resources have to be poured into the health service to cope with these problems. So it's something that you don't always think about, but I wondered how far you agree that's a major factor.
Oh, I think it's a huge factor, and I mean that was something I rather sort of mentioned in one sentence or something in my talk. But that central part of neoliberalism of intensifying work lengthening the hours of work, making work less autonomous, so that you have less and less control of your job, which is true not only in factories and call centres, but is also true for a lot of professional work, a lot of white collar work these days, a lot of office work, and so on. There's greater and greater intensity of work, and people feel they've completely lost control of their working lives, and also lost control in the sense of income security as well, the greater insecurity of income. So it's both those forms of insecurity. And I mean, surely that must contribute to enormous lack of self-worth, actually, you know, I think. Which is presumably is the thing which is causing this absolute epidemic in Britain of depression, and depression, anxiety, and so on. I mean, the sort of cultural, mental stuff that neoliberalism is doing to us is just appalling. And what's particularly appalling for me is the way in which there's a sort of awful catch-22 about it, because the more depressed and sort of ground down people become, to some extent, the less capacity they have to fight back. And it seems to me that the lack of fight back over the last 18 months in Britain against this damn recession and against people being laid off or having their hours cut or their wages cut and all this stuff that's been going on, especially in the private sector, but will happen, of course, now in the public sector as well. The fact there's been so little resistance to it, I mean, owes a lot. I mean, obviously, it owes a lot to the smashing of the trade unions by Thatcher and Labour as well. But I think it also is like a whole kind of cultural, well, personal cultural thing that people, can't see their way to resist anymore. They're so oppressed by this, by these impositions. So I couldn't agree with you more. And I think, you know, it actually has these political and economic effects as well, which is so frightening.
Thank you very much.
Sorry, that's a bit of a grim, though. It's a rather grim, pessimistic note to work on, isn't it?
A brandy to put in the coffee, then.
yes, how can we cheer ourselves up?
Well, I've still got quite a way of cheering people back, but I can't promise.
Yes, you'll cheer us up with your...
Maybe.
With your up and up...
I don't know about it. We'll see.
Can I just make a comment before you go?
Yeah.
Mm. I'm not an economist, but I can't help feeling that the fundamental cause of the so-called credit crunch is the deregulation and the unregulated nature of the banking system and the financial system as a whole, which created a new structure and culture of the banking system and the financial system, which was totally out of control.
Mm-hmm.
And also due to the betting and gambling, greed, and I would even say fraud,
yep,
where people have played with the money of the public, your money, my money, everybody's money.
Mm.
They were able to play with it, to gamble.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I am sure, just a lot of the sort of thing that we talk, greed and fraud on the part of individuals. And I would say that those who have done this have done a criminal job at society.
Well, I hope that, yes, I mean, I hope, well, Mr. Madoff is now in prison, I think. But and there's an awful lot of other fraudsters who are not yet in prison and so on. I mean, I agree with you up to a certain point, but I... I think the things you describe have undoubtedly been going on, but what I think we need to ask ourselves is to put this in a bigger framework. Why has it been that the American government, the most powerful economy in the world, and particularly the Federal Reserve, the Reserve Bank, the public, the National Bank of America, has systematically, since the late 1980s, that's to say, over 20 years, has systematically allowed this to go on. And they, of course, knew all these, you know, all these frauds, these mad types of speculation, creation of all these mad derivatives. Hey, they all knew this was going on. But they not only allowed it to go on, they encouraged it to go on. Greenspan, you know, deliberately allowed this massive expansion of credit and lending, which, and if you have a massive expansion of credit and lending, then a lot of the things are going to turn out to be worthless and not to have value. And then that, of course, encourages fraud because they have the, all that, you know, the financiers have to try to cover that up, as they did at Enron or and so on, or as Madoff did and so on. So I think one needs to see this in the bigger picture, and really, yes, to ask the question, why was this allowed? And my answer would be that the economy was in a kind of stagnation, was failing to revive, even with all these wage cuts and so on, even with all the bankruptcy of old industry and so on, that failed to revive the world economy. And so, the American government, the British government and so on thought, right, this expansion of credit will inject some energy into this system through this massive expansion of finance and credit. And so it wasn't just tolerated, it was positively encouraged for that reason. And it looked, and for it, to a certain extent, at some periods anyway, it looked as if it was working. I mean, there was a boom through the 1980s, from about 1992 to 2000, for about 8 years, there was quite a strong expansion of the world economy on the basis of all this credit. And then again in the noughties, after from about 2002 to 2007-08, there was quite a big boom. And so, you know, the governments were going, oh, so, you know, we've revived, and they were saying, we've revived the world economy. We're back on, you know, great path. And, you know, Gordon Brown said that it's the end of the era of boom and bust. We've overcome it all. It's all back to normal again. We're back to the 1950s. Fabulous. And they were congratulating themselves, and the City of London and so on were all congratulating themselves. So sort of yes and no, I suppose.
So they called it the Goldilocks economy, but they forgot about the three bears.